Hello, everyone. Another beautiful Sabbath day. This is almost like just a hint of autumn in the air. In fact, the whole week, I think, has been great. Really enjoyed it. I hope everyone has. I think most of you know I kind of like to talk about, the world tomorrow, the kingdom, beautiful things, the world in harmony, peace, love, beauty, all that thing. But reality kind of intrudes on that. And so today I was talking about where's America heading? Where are we heading as a nation? And will we continue down the road of humanism? And we have a capitalist system, I guess is what you would call our government, is capitalism. And some might say, well, it's capitalism, but it's being kind of changed to socialism. Some countries have communism, some fascism. There's a lot of isms. But when you get right down to it, it's actually humanism. And it's man's way, not God's way. It's what man thinks is right. And one thing about a humanistic government, it's always changing. Whoever's in charge, it's going to be different. It's going to be their way. Don't necessarily stick to tried and true principles, godly principles. And the question is, will we turn to God's Word for guidance, for truth? His Word is truth. His godly principles are tried and true, unchangeable. Will we turn as a nation to His Word for guidance? And will we choose a leader? We've got elections coming up in about a year, although you'd think it was next month, the way they're going. But will we choose a leader who fears, respects, and trusts God? Next question might be, well, is there such a man? We hope there is. Maybe there is. I don't know. Or will we choose a man who leans on his own understanding and his own wisdom? And we kind of know that doesn't work out too good. But many times it's hard to tell what you're getting until you get it. And then we might say, well, does our present leaders and judges, do they show love and respect for God's law? Or even our Constitution? And my opinion is not really. They seem to want to change it to fit the situation and to suit whatever they're trying to do at the time. So, and again, you might say, do some of our federal laws conflict with God's law? That's where we really get into a bad place, when the law of the land starts conflicting with God's law. We don't need to turn there, but Exodus 20, verse 13, it says, "Thou shalt not commit murder." Pretty plain, pretty simple. But what would we call it when they rip a child up, when they do an abortion? What would we call that? It gets to be pretty heart-wrenching when you see our laws conflicting. And that is the law of the land. Many people have worked really hard against it. And states have voted to do away with it. Or at least, in some cases, they've compromised and said partial abortions. But still yet, you'll have the judges will strike it down. So we continue in that way. Of course, Exodus 20:14 says, "Thou shalt not commit adultery." And we know that wrecks families as well as other things. Well, we don't seem to be doing too good there either, because we've interceded in marriage. We've changed marriage to mean who knows what. Between a man and a man, a woman and a woman, it's not as God ordained it, created and ordained it. So we're in very dangerous territory there. And And I guess my question is, can we expect to go unpunished as a nation for these kind of transgressions that go on and on for, you know? I think we even get desensitized to some of it. It just, it's like we can't get rid of it. It's always there. And can we expect to go unpunished? Let's turn to Isaiah 59. Isaiah 59, verse 2. It says, But your iniquities have separated you from your God. Your sins have hidden His face from you, so that He will not hear. For your hands are stained with blood, your fingers with guilt. Your lips have spoken lies, and your tongue mutters wicked things. No one calls for justice. No one pleads his case with integrity. Go down to verse 12. For our offenses are many in your sight, and our sins testify against us. Our offenses are ever with us, and we acknowledge our iniquities, rebellion and treachery against the Lord, turning our backs on our God, fomenting oppression and revolt, uttering lies our hearts have conceived. Verse 14, so justice is driven back and righteousness stands at a distance. Truth has stumbled in the streets. Some say fallen in the streets. Honesty cannot enter. Truth is nowhere to be found. And whoever shuns evil becomes a prey. Now, I know this was written over 2,000 years ago to ancient Israel, but doesn't it sound like it could be written today at any time? It's very sobering to read those things. And what happened to ancient Israel when they rebelled against God, refused to keep His commandments? What happened to them? Again, we don't have to go there, but 2 Kings 17... Chapter 17, 6 and 7 tells that Israel was conquered and exported, carried out of their land. They lost their land. They were captured and lost their land and their identity as well because of their sins. Even to this day, Israel, and when it speaks of Israel, it's not talking about the Jews we hear. It's talking about the 10 tribes, when it speaks of Israel, house of Israel, Ephraim, whatever, it's talking about the 10 tribes. And they lost their identity and to this day still have lost their identity. Well, what happened to Judah? Judah carried on for another, I think, 150 years or so. But eventually, they too were so wicked that they were conquered and driven from their land by, that's in 2 Kings 25. By Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar. And, of course, they were repatriated to their land later, about 70 years, and then again they were driven out by Rome and scattered until 1948 when they were finally brought back the second time. Unless we turn to God, can we expect anything better than that? Were their sins worse than ours? I'd hate to have to argue that case. Anyway, looking forward, prophecy indicates that we will be in captivity and slaves. That might seem very odd, and we say, well, maybe that couldn't happen. But prophecy indicates we'll be in captivity and slaves when Christ returns to earth. Let's go to Jeremiah 30. Verse 7. I'm getting lost. Yeah, verse 7. It says, how awful that day will be. None will be like it. And it's speaking of the end time, the return of Christ. It will be a time of trouble for Jacob. Here again, it's talking about Israel. But he will be saved out of it. Well, at least there's some good news. In that day, declares the Lord Almighty, I will break the yoke off their necks and will tear off their bonds. No longer will foreigners enslave them. Instead, they will serve the Lord their God and David their king, whom I will raise up for them. So do not fear, O Jacob, my servant. Do not be dismayed, O Israel. So, in the end time, it pictures us as being in a condition of slavery, although to be saved out of it, which is great news. And in closing, let's go to turn back to chapter 23. Jeremiah 23, verse 5. The days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will raise up to David a righteous branch, a king who will reign wisely and do what is just and right in the land. In his day, Judah will be saved, and Israel will live in safety. That is the name by which he will. This is the name by which he will be called, the ruler, of course. The name he will be called is the Lord our righteousness. So then, days are coming, declares the Lord, when people will no longer say, as surely as the Lord lives who brought the Israelites up out of Egypt. But they will say, as surely as the Lord lives who brought the descendants of Israel up out of the land of the north and out of all the countries where he had banished them. And they will live in their own land. So, even though bad things are ahead of us, I guess it will turn out good in the end.
Okay, the title of this message is Vanity, Absalom, and Us. Absalom makes a perfect model for vanity run amok. Let's just go to 2 Samuel 14. Get a glimpse of Absalom, David's son. And remember, since it's in Scripture, we have to presume it is an accurate description. 2 Samuel 14, thank you, verse 25 reads, "And now in all Israel there was no one who was praised, no one who was praised as much as Absalom for his good looks." Think of what that would do for your humility. No one was praised as much as Absalom for his good looks. "From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him." This kid was good looking, handsome. I mean, the Bible said so. "And when he cut the hair of his head," I kind of think of the Fabio look, but he probably looked better than Fabio. When he cut the hair of his head at the end of every year, he cut it because heavy. And I assume it was a public spectacle, you know, done around witnesses, and they would weigh his hair at 200 shekels according to the king's standards. So he had long hair and probably all piled up, and he would cut it once a year and make a big to-do of it. So he was good-looking, and he knew it, to put it bluntly. And think about it. When you were a prince in Israel, which was becoming a more powerful, wealthy nation because of David's blessings or God's blessings to David, as king, and all his, he conquered all the nations around them. Actually, when David finished, Israel was as big as it would ever get, you know, from the Euphrates down to Egypt. They controlled all that. So he was a prince in a wealthy, powerful Israel. You kind of look at what's going on in Britain, you get some idea what it's like to be a prince. That's going to spoil you a little bit. And then he was the handsomest man, and his dad was indulgent. I think all of us can understand indulgent parents, can't we? And probably most of us, if we could raise our kids all over again, we're all saying, boy, I'd do a better job of it if I had another shot at it. Anyway, Ezekiel 28, verse 17. I just want to show you some similarities here. We'll get to how all this relates to us in a minute. Ezekiel 28, verse 17. It starts off talking about the Prince of Tyre, but in the duality of Bible prophecy, it morphs to Lucifer. Verse 17, referring to Lucifer, says, "Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty." He's one of the cherubs. Your you corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor. I don't really know what a cherub looks like. I've seen descriptions, hard for us to imagine. But whatever they look like, Lucifer was one of the most splendiferous. And Lucifer means light bringer, so it probably was bright and beautiful and pipes and great music. And you were corrupted, your wisdom, for the sake of your splendor. So the Bible said he had splendor. I cast you to the ground. In other words, he was kicked out of heaven. Then it goes back to more mundane things. But what got Satan in trouble? The vanity caused by his beauty and his splendor. You see a certain similar pattern there, don't you, between him and Absalom. He got lifted up, sort of like bright sunlight. So the thing we must remember is that God requires people to be humble, because God doesn't want what happened to Satan to happen to us. Because angels are free moral agents, obviously, and you see what happened to Satan. Let's go to Matthew 5. And the material I'm giving you, these are all things that we know. There's nothing here I'm saying that you all haven't heard before, but I think it's worth it to mention each of these. Because sometimes we ask ourselves, why did Christ say what he said in Matthew 5? And when you look at Satan and Absalom, it becomes clear why he said it. Matthew 5, verse 3. Here are the people that are going to be in God's kingdom. Blessed are the meek, or poor, or humble. All those are appropriate translations of that word. Blessed are the meek in spirit, or humble, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Why does God want humble people in the kingdom? To avoid what happened to Satan and the devil. And we'll see what happened to Absalom in a minute. Now, we can get a little bit vain because we know truths that few people know. Right? We know Bible truths and some related areas that few people know, so you can get vain about the knowledge we have that others have. But the truth is, we have that knowledge not because we're wiser, smarter, cuter, more charisma. If you look at us, you say, oh, you old people, anyway. That isn't going to happen, but we have it because God has opened our mind and called us. That's why we have it. If we go to 1 Corinthians chapter 1, we will just see the plain statement. Because Paul was having trouble with the Corinthian church, and he was kind of putting them in their place. 1 Corinthians 1, and we'll be going through this chapter in our Bible study very soon, the whole book, verse 26. And he says, I'll start in verse 25, get the context. Verse 24. But to those who are called both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God, and the wisdom of God, because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. Men have all these great philosophies and isms. When we look at those in the future, and we look at them more accurately, we'll laugh at them. Evolution, humanism, socialism, communism, a whole bunch of other. We'll laugh at them. They'll be so obviously discredited. We'll have accurate historical records, which now that isn't as true as it should be. History is perverted like other things. But there's enough evidence now you could know the truth if you looked at it carefully. For you see your calling, brethren, that not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called. God called the weak, the little people, not the mighty or the great, or whoever you think of the top people in the world. He didn't call, as far as I know, any of the Kennedys or Bushes or whoever you think is powerful and great in this world, he hasn't called any of those people. But one of the devil's traps is vanity and, say, vanity-driven ambition trap. And I'll tell you a story about someone I caught in the vanity-ambition combination trap. By the way, ambition is not wrong if it's ambition to serve. You know, if you look at all the scriptures, Paul says, you know, to be an elder, a bishop, he says it's a good thing. But when you read everything that Paul says, he's talking about serving, or serving in any capacity in the church, whatever you're doing. Service is what Paul, and of course Paul exemplified that by doing everything he did for all those churches, for, and many cases, for no pay. We'll see that when we get to the book of Corinthians as well. It's serving. In other words, if you do something to serve, that's one thing. But if you're doing it out of, I'll call it, vanity-driven ambition, then you're falling into the trap that Satan is setting out for us, more of the self-centered kind of trap. We'll go to Acts 20 because I want to put it in context. Then we're going to go back to Absalom and see how all this applies to Absalom and can apply to us as well. This is Acts 20. Now, in context of Acts 20, Paul went out of his way as he's going to Jerusalem, and he thinks from prophecies he's going to be arrested, which he's right. He's going to go to Rome, and he's not sure if he'll ever get back there to see the Ephesian elders. So he has them meet him at a certain point, and he talks with them, and he cries with them. He tells them what they have to do to take care of the flock, all those churches that Ephesus is one of the bigger churches in that area. Some other sub-churches came off as well. Paul is giving them life-ending type advice. So Acts 20, verse 29. Notice what he says. For I know this, that after my departure, savage wolves will come in among you, not sparing the flock. One of the things we already know, just from what we, even in Paul's day, not so much after him, when Paul would start a congregation in Galatians or Colossians or Ephesians, after Paul left town, the Judaizing party, and then I believe some others as well, came in there to mess things up after Paul left. Because Paul was, they couldn't get away with certain things when Paul was there. He had a lot of spiritual power, and I, apparently Paul's logic, they couldn't shake it. But when Paul left, you know, so like someone said about the Iranian deal, they heard that the Iranians will actually be policing a lot of it themselves. Like the fuck? And I mean, when you know it's a bad deal anyway, because you know they're going to play games like they always do, but when the fox is guarding the hen house, you know you're in trouble. Well, you know, when the chief protector of the hens is gone, the fox is going to come in and eat. That's the point I'm making. Verse 30. But also, this is the part that I'm emphasizing the most, verse 30. Also, from among yourselves, these are among the elders that Paul approved of and knew and worked with and probably suffered with and cried with. Among yourselves, men will rise up speaking perverse things to draw away disciples after themselves. In other words, some of the people who were good at one point and servants will decide they want their own personal following. How did Paul know that? I don't know. Paul predicted, prophesied a lot of things, and they all came true. He knew that. And then, of course, they all cried together, and you know. But it happened, obviously, and that's part of church history. Now, obviously, for those people who pull off a personal following, it always ends badly for both the person who does it and those who follow him. And I've seen a lot of examples. I've been in the ministry for, let's see, 36 years, 36, 37. I've been in the church, well, a few more years would be half a century. Natalie's been in over half a century. But we've seen all kinds of stuff. And people call me about problems in their areas, and I'll mention one or two of them in this message. So I'm aware of a lot of stuff. So believe me, it almost always ends badly for both parties, the ones that go off with somebody and the person who leads them off. Just this past year, and I'm going to not mention cities and names, so you won't know who I'm talking about because I want to maintain confidentiality, but in a city somewhere in America, a particular man, and I did warn him on the phone, but it doesn't matter, he didn't. Some people won't listen to advice because, you know. Anyway, a man in a city, a particular person who is a spiritual predator on our church, has been for a number of years, and he was after a lot of people, he's after whoever he can get because he's desperate to get people because his things aren't working out. Well, there's an older man I talked to in the same church, same city, and the older man said, yeah, he was after me as well, but I wasn't interested. But he said, Mr. X, the guy I'm referring to, he said, he was easy for this man to get. And he said the reason it was easy for him to get is he has vanity-driven ambition. And I thought about it, and I know the guy. I said, yeah, it does seem that way. He was an easy mark. All this guy had to do was just imply, you come along with me and you'll get ordained someday. It's like putting a hook in the water and yanking it in the prey. And sure enough, he's gone off, and he may have one person out of that group going with him. We don't know for sure that that person is, I mean, I say too much. You may figure out who it is, but the man said, he said, he'll be easy because he's got that vanity-driven ambition. He'll be easy to hook. And certainly that was the case. I know another case, another city further south. This happened about a year and a half ago. A man and his wife were friends of another man and his wife. And he came up with a wedge issue. I won't mention the issues. We won't figure out who it is. And I guess we just didn't figure out what was going on too long. He brought up the wedge issue. Sure enough, now he has people meeting in his home. He has now, well, him and his wife and the other couple, four people meeting in his home. He's got his own little group. It's not going to turn out good. And this guy, well, maybe there's a little more involved in it, but there's a certain vanity involved in the whole thing. All I can say is, if you're not careful, you're like a fish with bait. Like Mr. X was an easy mark, as the older man said. He said, I knew he was an easy mark. And the devil knows how to play off vanity, how to use that hook. Now, let's look at Absalom, because I want to give you that story. It's a good Bible story to get an idea of what not to do. So we're going to go back to 2 Samuel, and I'll try to do it. We're not going to read it all, but I'll try to give you a decent description of the story of Absalom and how it happened. Now, Absalom had his assistants kill his half-brother, and David, well, actually, there's a little more to the story. The half-brother raped the half-sister, and David didn't do anything about it. So it's clear that David did not discipline his sons as he should have, and he was an indulgent parent. Probably he spent a lot of time away from his kids because he was at war, out in the field, and doing all that kingly stuff, and probably had servants dealing with the kids. Well, if you're a servant and you work for the king and it's the king's kids, do you have any real incentive to really give them tough discipline? You know, think about it. I mean, just logically how that's, you know, and you see all the scandals of the royal family in England, you get some idea what probably went on, though we don't have all the details. But we do know that David didn't discipline Amnon, and so Absalom had his assistants kill them. So this, and then he worked his way back into the castle by using intrigue and other things. Let's go to 2 Samuel 15. We'll give you some idea of what Absalom was like. 2 Samuel 15, verse 1. This is after he finally wormed his way back into Jerusalem. And he said, after this, it happened that Absalom provided himself with chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. Kind of like his own version of ancient PR. He's got 50 servants and probably several beautiful chariots, and he's probably decked out in royal red or gold and purple, something like that. And he's standing on the road to enter Jerusalem, and probably with the help of his assistants, when someone he knows is coming to go before the king with their own legal problems, he runs up to them, and he seduces them. I'll read the rest of it here. Now, Absalom would rise early, you know, early, so he'd be sure to get them, and stand by the way of the gate, because the gate was like a city hall where court things were done. They had like little buildings over the main gate and the walls of the city. So he was there before you got there. So it was when anyone who had a lawsuit came to the king for a decision, Absalom would call to him and say, what city are you from? And he would say, your servant is from, you know, some connection to them, you know, which is clever politics. Verse 3, then Absalom would say to him, look, your case is good and you are right. He probably told both sides that. Then the other guy on the other side, you know, since he doesn't have to make the decision, he can say anything he wants. He probably told both sides, oh, yeah, you're right, you're right. If I was king, it would go your way. Your case is right. But there's no deputy of the king to hear you. Now, the king is really not doing his duty here. Moreover, Absalom would say, oh, that if I were made judge in the land, which is an implied way of saying if I were king, everyone who had any suit or cause would come to me and I would give him justice. A man like you would get what you wanted. And he did that for several years. Verse 5. And so it was, whenever anyone came near to bow down to him, he would put out his hand and say, no, don't bow down to me. And he would, you know, hug him, and like men in the Middle East kiss each other on the side of the cheek. That's a technique called the plain folks propaganda technique. It's actually a technique. Like if you see a powerful politician, and when the TV cameras are on for a few minutes, you see him carrying his own luggage. You think, oh, look at that. He carries his own luggage like regular people. Don't believe it. He doesn't do this. He's got tons of servants and assistant servants. But when the TV cameras are on at certain, they call them photo ops, he plays the humble man. He's rich and powerful, or powerful at least, and on his way to being rich, you know, big time. But it's a clever technique. And Absalom played all that to the hill. And he probably was not only good looking, but charming. You know, with a certain political savvy and charming. And he had vanity-driven ambition. And eventually, he pulled off a coup, and he got the majority of the people to support him. And he was coming with a large entourage on Jerusalem. The last minute, David learned of it. Now, here's probably what happened. Probably at some point, a few of David's servants said, your son Absalom is plotting against you. David said, no, I don't want to hear it. I love my son Absalom. I don't want to hear it. It can't be true. He's such a cute, wonderful boy. So they stopped telling him. When you read, even when Absalom was defeated, David cried for the son who tried to kill him. I'm giving some idea how indulgent David was, how much he loved his kids. And when I look at my grandkids, I understand it. If you think about it, it's very understandable. You know, you understand you love your kids regardless. But so I'm making the point here that David chose not to fight in Jerusalem because that's the city that he developed, he loved. He didn't want to make it a battleground. So at the last minute, David and his assistants left the city. So Absalom got into the city, you know, with all his forces, and everything looked like it was going to be, you know, Absalom was going to win. Now, I want to tell you this story, but the story has a point, kind of, a little point that fits into what we're saying. The story is called The Hikers. One day, Joe and Bob and Dave were hiking in the wilderness area, and they came upon a large, raging, violent river, and they had to get to the other side. So Joe prayed to God, God, give me the strength to cross this river. Poof! He had these big muscle arms. You know, he really got some guns. And he swam the river. He almost drowned once or twice. It took him 2 hours, but he got across it. So Dave, seeing that, he said, God, give me the strength and the tools to cross the river. Poof! He got stronger, and he got a little rowboat. And he rowed across. The river is so raging, almost capsized him once or twice. But it took him only 1 hour. He got to the other side. Well, Bob, having seen all that, he said, God, give me the strength, the tools, and the wisdom to get across the river. And poof, he became a woman. Read the map, walked 100 yards to the bridge, and walked over. You know, they say that men are too vain to look at a map. I know the way, I can always find my way. Or men are too vain to read the instructions. Actually, I know how it is. These instructions are so complex, I can figure it out. But isn't that true that sometimes men are too vain to read all the instructions? Nobody is smiling, right? Well, that's the danger of being too vain. And the crucial part of the story, let's go to 2 Samuel 16. 23. We get to the crucial part of the story with Absalom and explain how his vanity led to his death. 2 Samuel 16, 23. By the way, Ahithophel was one of several major advisors that David had that gave David good advice. By the way, smart people surround themselves with smart people, good advisors. I was listening to Donald Trump the other night, and he implies that he knows the best negotiator. He'll surround himself with smart people. Who knows if that's true or not? It makes you wonder. But I do wonder about some of the people surrounding our politicians. Like, anyway, David surrounded himself with smart people. Let's read verse 23. Now, the advice of Ahithophel, which he gave in those days, was as if one inquired at the oracle of God. So was all the advice of Ahithophel, both with David and Absalom. In other words, this man gave godly advice that was right, that was correct, that was, you know, he didn't make mistakes. He gave you really good advice. He was brilliant in that respect. I don't know if you call him the Karl Rove or the Henry Kissinger, because Kissinger gave the advice of the, you know, with Nixon to help him divide the communist world. But anyway, you get some idea of a great advisor. You get the feel of what it means. Now, the only chance that Absalom had to defeat David and replace him was to follow Ahithophel's advice. Ahithophel said that very night when they arrived in Jerusalem, the gates were open, and David had just left probably a few hours later on the run. Ahithophel said, find to me 15,000 of your best soldiers, give them to me, and I will kill David immediately before anything else can happen. And Ahithophel thought, well, that sounds like good advice. But then he said, let's see what the other top advisor, Hushai, says. David had sent Hushai back. You know, Hushai wanted to stay with David. David said, no, you're just going to slow things down. You're not a good fighter. You're an advisor. So I want you to go back, pretend to be on Absalom's side, and counter the good advice that Ahithophel is going to give. In other words, be a counter spy. And Hushai thought about it. Of course, he realized Ahithophel was quite correct. That was the only chance Absalom had, was to get David right away. Because if David got away and got a chance to organize, David's soldiers were battle-hardened. They'd won all those victories all around. And, well, there's stories in the Bible about David's mighty men, 30 men. You read some of the exploits those guys did. I mean, those guys were tough. They, you know, it's like they wear their clothes out from the inside. David's men were disciplined. He'd been battle-hardened for years, tough. There was no way that Absalom could defeat David in battle if they didn't get David right away. Ahithophel realized it. Hushai realized it too. But he said, if I appeal to Absalom's vanity, he will ignore that good advice. You can read the whole thing, but I'm going to go to 2 Samuel 17:11. He says that what you need to do is, don't worry about David for now. I'm going to take a couple of months. Get this huge army from all of Israel, north and south, and you lead it yourself. Now think of Absalom thinking of himself probably with a gold shield, a big purple cape, maybe a plumed hat like Alexander the Great. You know, well, how he would view it at any rate in those days. Leading this vast army and everybody looking at Absalom. There's no way with his vanity he could pass up that opportunity. I'll read the scripture, 2 Samuel 17:11. And Hushai did a good job of setting it up, too. He said, therefore, I advise that all Israel be fully gathered to you. Now, there's a huge army from Dan to Beersheba, north to south, like the sand is by the sea for the multitude. And that you know, yourself go in battle in person. And you think, I get the fame of taking out the famous David. You know, Absalom's ego is like, by the way, Ahithophel, the moment his advice wasn't taken, he knew that he had supported a fool and an idiot. He knew he made a mistake. He went home, made out his will, and hung himself. Even before in the battle, he knew at that point it was over. That's how smart he was. He said, the details will work themselves out, but it's over. They don't get David right away, it's over. So he appealed to his vanity. Absalom was like a fish to be caught and reeled in because his vanity made him so vulnerable. A vanity-driven ambition. 2 Samuel 18:8. Now, the battle was in the forest of Ephraim where the two armies met. Absalom's army is probably over twice the size of David's army, but sometimes size doesn't always matter. It's where the two armies meet, if you know what I mean. And, well, we'll read it and take some idea of what we think happened. Verse 8, 2 Samuel 18:8. For the battle there was scattered over the face of the whole countryside, and the woods devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. In other words, when David's battle-hardened troops met Absalom, who probably didn't know in the world what he was doing and didn't pick good generals, they plus all a bunch of flattery, David's army in the front lines made Absalom's army totally run. You know, they broke ranks, ran into the forest, and they actually killed more of themselves, tripping over themselves in the forest, than David's army killed. That's what it meant by the forest devoured more people. It was like panic. Have you ever seen a big army panic? They're all running all of these. Ah, we're losing, getting out of the way. It's if you were to compare that, it'd be sort of like the St. Louis Cardinals versus a Little League team. They wouldn't have a chance. Or the Pittsburgh Steelers and their Iron Curtain versus a little Pop Warner football team. That's about how bad it was. Once they clashed with David's troops, it was like Disasterville. Well, when all that disaster happened, and you know, there's Absalom, probably not knowing what in the world's going on, because David told the soldiers not to kill his son, because that's how much he loved his son. And he says his troops are totally running and total defeat, but nobody's attacking him. He said, what? You know, he had no real command and control. Well, eventually he realized, I better run. So he turns his horse and mule around, and he starts running. Let me read verse 9. It's kind of comic. It's humor in the whole thing, if you look at it that way. Then Absalom met the servants of David. Absalom rode on a mule. Then the mule went under a thick bough of a great terebinth tree, and his head got caught in the terebinth. So he was left hanging between heaven and earth, and the horse ran out from under him, a mule. I actually saw a drawing of this. With his big, long hair, I guess the tree had branches with little things out of it. And as he rolled, you know, fast, it was stuck in all that hair. And then the horse ran out from under. And there he is dangling with his feet. Ah! You think, why did he pick up a knife and cut off his hair? That would have been terrible to cut his hair like that. I don't know. He probably panicked, didn't know what to do. There he's dangling in the air. And needless to say, eventually, David's top general realized, in spite of what David said, we're not going to let this guy live. And a bunch of men all stabbed him and threw darts at him, and then they put him in an old ditch and buried him. You know, no funeral for him. That was it. Now, you realize he could have spent his whole life as a royal, wealthy prince. He may have gotten the throne someday. Maybe that, we don't know for sure about that. But he could have had his whole life as a royal prince. But his vanity-driven ambition set him up for that death. That's the danger of vanity-driven ambition. You do things that you shouldn't do. Not that David did anything. David actually tried not to hurt him. Went out of his way to avoid hurting him, but the kid just, you know, went too far, and David's servants knew he couldn't be left alive. He'd be troubled. Let's look at Ahithophel, the good advisor. Why did he switch sides? There is some possibility he had some other grudges against David. But the Bible evidence of that is really sparse. I'm just going to guess. I could be wrong on this one. I think he switched sides because he put his finger in the political wind, and the wind was blowing Absalom. Does that make sense? If they had polls in those days, like you do now, 70% of the public supports Absalom. David's getting old. He doesn't, you know, get around like he used to, and he's made decisions that some people didn't like. And Absalom is young, and he's handsome. Maybe he's 40, 35, 40, something. He's young, and he's handsome, and he's energetic, and everybody loves him, and he knows what to say to make people like him. And, you know, if he were on TV, he'd be Mr. Celebrity. You think of it, all that hair, and then the Bible said he was perfect. I mean, the Bible said he was handsome, so it's not a question of, you know, so he probably was. Here he was, the handsomest man, probably. All that hair. Hair can be bad for you. You either can have hair or you can have brains. But he's got all that hair, and it's interesting, his hair got him killed. But the point is, Ahithophel put his finger in the air, and the winds were blowing Absalom, so he switched sides. By the way, if you're a key advisor to a king in those days, picking the right side is life or death. Let's say if he had stayed with David and Absalom had won Absalom would have killed David and all his top advisors. That's what they did. They call it cleaning house. And in today's world, they just fire you, pick other people. In those days, they killed you. So he guessed wrong. Here's what he should have done. He should have been loyal to David because David was God's anointed. David was chosen by God. And there's something to be said for that. Now you say, but David wasn't perfect. But that isn't really required. Because I can go through the Bible, and it mentions faults of many of the Bible's chosen people, like Abraham. And anyway, we can go through the list. So it doesn't matter. The God's chosen doesn't have to be perfect. But I think he should have said, if this is God's chosen, he's going to stay in power until God removes him. I shouldn't help somebody else with a coup d'etat to remove him. And I think that was, and I'm sure when Ahithophel committed suicide, he realized it. I would have been better off saying, Lord, this fool doesn't know what he's doing. And I see a lot of people getting elected to high office, and I think, this fool doesn't know what he's doing. You think the same thing, right? And oftentimes, a bad leader can get away with it for a while. Maybe the devil blesses him. He gets lucky. It's like if you look at World War II, you could look at it as a competition strategically between Churchill and Hitler. That's no contest. Churchill was an experienced, he graduated from the West Point of Britain, Sandhurst, when he was a young man. He was a hero in the Boer War, which you probably heard that story. He was should have been made a general in World War I, but his political enemies blocked it. But the point I'm getting at, he invented the concept of the tank and the aircraft carrier, and he understood geopolitics, where Hitler was a bum. Maybe he was a good speaker, but he was a bum. Sooner or later, you're going to run out of luck. That's what I mean. And I think Ahithophel realized, this guy may have gotten away with stealing the people's heart, but I should have realized I should have stuck with God's anointed. I think the three insights we can come out of Absalom's story with. Three insights. Number one, God requires humility. Be afraid of vanity and vanity-driven ambition. Absalom got killed by his hair. Number two, you're an easy mark for the devil when you're driven by that kind of vanity. The devil can just, get a little hook for you, some little special attention, and get you to do something you shouldn't do. When you're vain, it's like you're an easy mark. They say a con man can't con a really honest, steady person. It has to be somebody who's a little greedy, a little vain. They know how to play it. And number three, vanity undermines loyalty. And I believe God requires and values humility and loyalty.